Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. The global scandal surrounding the release of the Panama Papers, as well as Malcolm Turnbull's criticism of Australian banks this week, have put the spotlight on the often murky world of banking and finance. Today we're joined by Tasmanian Greens Senator Peter Wish-Wilson. He's the party's finance spokesman, and he had a pre-parliamentary life in banking. So he brings some special expertise to the present controversies. Senator, Malcolm Turnbull gave the banks a real bollocking this week, but the government still is not inclined to have a royal commission into the behaviour of the financial sector. You advocate a royal commission. What's the case for one?
Well, I think a bollocking is not going to achieve any results. The Murray Financial Service Inquiry was looking at this issue and didn't release any strong recommendations either. Nearly 15 months ago, the Senate Economics Committee released a recommendation for a Royal Commission just into Commonwealth Bank, because we thought as a committee, and it was quite an extraordinary thing to do, we didn't have the resources or the time nor the investigative powers to get to the bottom of that scandal. That's just one scandal. Since then, we've seen numerous financial scandals, and I've been consistently asking questions in Senate question time to Senator Brandis, Senator Cormann, around a cultural issue in the banks. Now, you did mention that I have a background in banking. One of the reasons that I walked away from that industry was because of the culture, this incessant chasing profits and a bonus-driven culture. You're only as good as your last sale. And I think the culture of any organisation starts at the top, and the way they actually incentivise their employees from the CEO down is the root cause of the problem. And although that profit-driven culture is not on its own illegal, it can be often unethical, and it can lead to risk-taking and individual circumventing the laws. And I also don't think the law is necessarily strong enough. So I think a Royal Commission is probably the only thing we can do to look at the broader, more pervasive problem about the culture within the industry and the risks that individuals in the industry are prepared to take.
What was your own position in banking?
So I had numerous positions. My final position was what we call equity capital markets. So I was working between corporates, so taking CEOs of large corporations around to meet with some of the biggest investors, certainly in Southeast Asia, and I also worked on Wall Street in New York. So I was a go-between man for the corporate sector within the finance raising arm. I also worked as a research, equity salesperson. So I would actually pitch our, and I was working for the late Merrill Lynch at that time. I'd be selling our firm's research recommendations to large sophisticated investors.
Now, you speak about being aware of the bad culture.
Yeah.
Did people in that you were working with and in the sector more widely that you interacted with, were they happy with that sort of culture, or did you find that there were critics within the sector?
Look, there are critics within the sector, and I think it's important to say that there are also some very good people that I work with, and I keep in touch with some of them now. In fact, quite often they'll send me information and I'll bounce ideas off them. I think they're in it once you get to a point where you're making good money and you've got mortgages and kids at private school, especially if you live in Sydney and Melbourne. You do tend to get caught up in it, and it's hard to walk away from. I remember when I walked away from it when I was living in Sydney, one of the guys I was working with said, you'll never make money like this ever again. You're mad. Your kids are only 3 and 4 years old. What
and
are you doing?
And is it true?
Well, I'd already figured that money wasn't all it was cracked up to be, and that going living in Tassie, I had a little vineyard that I'd set up. So I must admit I had set myself up, and there's a lot more to life than making bucks. In fact, the whole journey that my life journey has been about learning and realizing what is important to me in life. So, and I think they're all good. There's a lot of good people there, but the problem is with management, as much as it is with the foot soldiers. The management at all levels are incentivized on how much money those below them make, from CEO down. And until you actually change that incentive structure, the way that they're paid, you'll probably never change that culture. And probably the only way you can actually generate a very big message and make a dent in that is to actually have something like a Royal Commission that sends a very strong signal. And that way you're providing negative incentives for that kind of behaviour.
Now, the leaked Panama Papers are said to identify hundreds of Australians with links to so-called offshore service providers. What do you think should be done to stop individuals and Australian companies from hiding their wealth through these mechanisms?
Yeah. So, look, we can come up with literally dozens of different policy ideas on how we can go about combating this. The problem with some of the measures is that you do rely on other countries to participate and to cooperate, and that requires essentially a multilateral agreement between countries. Now, the G20 is looking at some of these issues. I got six or seven different things I could think of, from looking at putting in place rules for thin capitalization, for profit shifting, transfer pricing. You're not going to be able to do some of these things under the current trade arrangements we have, these big trade deals that we sign up to. Even something like saying you will penalise a government contractor, if they, we've talked about Wilson Security in the last week, if they're not doing the right thing, that you can provide a penalty that they won't get government work. Even that would be contravening trade deals. So there's things I think we need to do that involve regional cooperation, but we actually need to do that in the right forum, and I don't think the G20, which is not necessarily enforceable, is going to receive those out, will get us good outcomes in time. I think we need to properly resource the ATO. I think we need to have proper whistleblowing laws in this country. Literally, I can think about 20 things I think we need to do, but it needs to be comprehensive, and it needs to give both more resources and more investigative powers, both to ASIC and to the ATO. Now, and increased transparency. So including, for example, providing funds for the ATO to actually hire good people from the big four who they often compete against. I'm confident that there'll be cross-party support for working on that kind of thing, although I am disappointed that with the laws, the combating multinational tax avoidance laws we passed late last year, which we had, a start to increase transparency, over $200 million for private individuals. There was a lot of petty politics played around that by the Labor Party. But there's more, but we all have to work together on this issue, and I think the Australian people expect it.
The recent revelations about company tax avoidance have called into question in some people's minds the apparent intention of the government and the budget to cut company tax. Mm. Do you see any sort of link there? Do you think that this discredits a company tax cut, or do you think that really a company tax cut is a completely different issue driven by other needs?
Well, I think it discredits it politically, and there's no doubt about that, because the average person out there, if they don't pay their tax, and it's proportional to who you are and how much you earn and what you own, but if you don't pay your tax, you'll get a serious kick in the backside and potentially fines or more. So I think Australians are rightly saying, well, if that's the case for me, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. But I think realistically and effectively, it undermines the message anyway, because if you don't actually know what their effective tax rate is, that's what they're actually paying after a lot of these legal loopholes and deductions, then why give them a tax cut in the first place? Because they probably don't need it. If their effective tax rates are 5, 10, 15%, there's already laws in place that allow them to make those deductions. So it's probably not as all it's cracked up to be by the Business Council that are pushing this. I supported and I drove it very hard within the Greens to give small business a tax cut. My wife and I both own small businesses, so we know how hard it is. That's been supported by the government. And we led on that in the last election. So I'm not against a tax cut to small business. But I would say for bigger businesses who have the means and the resources to, let's say, avoid paying tax, I think it's a fallacious argument.
In this debate about whether we have a spending problem or a revenue problem or both, I would presume that you would say we have certainly a revenue problem, but do we have a spending problem as a nation?
Well, look, I think you could find areas where we could have more efficiency, and I think Richard Di Natale, our Greens leader, has outlined areas within health. He believes we could get increased efficiency, like spending more money on preventative health care, which makes long-term savings costs. So we're definitely not poo-pooing the idea of making of spending cuts, but it would depend on exactly what we're talking about. The issue for us is that focusing on spending alone and on costs, which is what we had in the first budget, distracts from the overall conversation of raising revenue. And more importantly, and more holistically about whether the tax system we have is actually fair and equitable. So we were careful as a party not to get drawn into just talking about revenue raising per se, or spending per se, but rather how do we structure our fiscal and monetary system to be more fair on Australians. And that's why we have looked at initiatives, and I think we've led on initiatives like getting rid of negative gearing, getting rid of capital gains tax concessions, and of course, it was our party's legacy of probably one of the biggest tax restructurings in this country in generations, and that was the carbon price and the clean energy package. So we are prepared to come up with alternatives, and we have actually led on some of these things.
Your background is as an economist, your training. How do you find the quality of economic debate in the parliament?
Look, I think it's the actual parliamentary side of it, the committee work that I've been doing, I think it's been good. I think working with senior bureaucrats and public servants within Treasury and other, I've found very rewarding. I think that's the parliament side and the policy side, but obviously the politics of it all often overrides that and makes it murky. I think just the short term media cycles we see make it very difficult for long term collaboration on these kind of things.
Well, what do you think of the debate in the media the media reflecting the economic debate? Do you think it's enough in depth or too superficial?
Look, I think the economic debate itself is actually, it's quite complicated for a lot of people. And I think there's something to be said for actually making it simple for people to understand. I mean, I used to teach at uni for years, and the art of actually trying to make it simple for people is an important one. But I think it's gone beyond that in terms of especially social media, where you can make a comment and you can attach an article, and you would hope people would read the article, like your fantastic stuff you write. But I find that often they don't. They might just rely on a headline, or they'll rely on, was it 60 characters on Twitter? I can't remember exactly what it is. And I remember when I started, Bob Brown gave me some advice, and he said, smile and look good for the pictures. And if you're lucky, people will look at your picture and maybe read the headline and won't read much more than that. So I know that's not the case for everyone, but as a general rule, it was a bit of a dour thing to say when I first started, because I am actually interested in the detail myself, and I find it quite fascinating and intellectually stimulating. But I think getting Australians to come on board is something I think we all have to work a lot harder on.
Now, the government's recalling the Senate to consider the industrial legislation, which the Greens have strongly opposed. Do you think it's possible that when the Senate gets back, the numbers will be there to decide not to look at the legislation, just to go on strike, as it were? Do you think this will be proposed? If it's proposed, will it be supported?
Look, I think, and as a party, we would like to have the debate on corruption per se. We'd like to have the debate on corruption within the union movement, corruption within the financial services sector. I mean, something I've been campaigning on for years, within politics. We've been going, that goes back over a decade, what we've been campaigning on there, and a lot of other areas. And I actually think Australians, just about anyone you'd speak to on the street, would support a national ICAC style body, especially looking into politics. So I think it's very important that we have that debate. I think the issue around ABCC and whether we have the numbers, I haven't been involved in
the Building and Construction
Commission. The Australian Building Construction Commission. I can only go on gut feeling on this. I don't have any information you don't have, except that I'd be surprised if we don't actually debate it when we're recalled. But I can't give you any solid basis for that. I haven't been involved in any discussions with the crossbenchers myself. The leader's office would have been doing that.
So you think there'll be a debate?
Yeah.
Do you think in the end the bill will be rejected?
Yeah, it comes down to, I suppose, a constitutional interpretation of whether it is a rejection or not. Whether a significant amendment would be considered particularly in high court challenges being a rejection, or whether that's actually considered to be the role of the Senate. In fact, with the multinational tax avoidance bill, which had a lot to it, I actually put up an amendment to that bill, which was the tax transparency bill that had previously been lost in the Senate. It was a bit cheeky, and it was substantially different. But the government ended up accepting that in the end. There's a precedent there that I've seen in my short time in Parliament where that you can actually significantly amend a legislation to improve it. Now, that's the way I see the Senate's role. If a High Court was to look at that kind of thing, would they think we were doing our job? If the debate was to go through a certain time, if it was to go to committee to be properly looked at, I think these are things that we're getting advice on, and that we'll have to wait and see how it pans out. But I think it'll come down to whether the Labor Party, I suppose, see whether the politics are falling in their favour in terms of being able to actually go in and campaign strongly on this issue going into a double dissolution or potential double dissolution.
Just on this suggestion that it should be broadened, the ABCC should be broadened into a national ICAC, surely that whether we need a national ICAC or whether other industries should be investigated, other sectors, is a different matter to the ABCC, isn't it? How it just seems conceptually it would be very hard to broaden such a body as proposed in the legislation to an ICAC-like body, which is a completely different thing, really.
Yeah, we took advice on this. Adam Bandt put up an amendment in the lower house that actually broadened the original legislation. So I think we have actually sought advice on that, and we think it's legislatively possible. I mean, at the end of the day, what it's focusing on essentially is corruption. But it's corruption within
within one sector. But it's conceptually messy, isn't it?
I think if you were to provide a body that had the powers to do what the government wants to do in the building and construction industry, that would hold the union movement or corruption within the union movement to account. But they also had similar powers to do it in other industries. I don't see that as being conceptually messy. I see that as being a simple solution to a much bigger problem.
You'd require a totally different sort of staff, though, for example.
You need more resources. There's no doubt about that. I mean, the appropriations issue could potentially be significant. But I think the benefits to having that kind of body and that kind of resourcing, going back to what we were discussing earlier about white-collar crime, there's a much bigger issue here. And I genuinely think, Michelle, that this is such a significant issue, not just because of the Panama Papers, but it's been evolving in the papers in the last few weeks with the banks. The MIS inquiry we released recently was absolutely shocking in the kind of stuff we saw that financial planners and others have got away with. I think this is actually a really big national issue, and I think the Prime Minister's probably been too smart by half to bring this to the Senate and not expect that we would want to deal with bigger issues while the bill was up.
Ideally, though, do you think these issues should be dealt with by one new national body, or should there be separate bodies?
I think there already is separate bodies within states, some of them have different powers. So I think actually centralising them and streamlining them would probably be a more effective way of doing that.
Let's assume that the industrial legislation fails to pass and we have this double dissolution on July 2. How do you think the Greens will go?
That's a good question. I think depending on who you believe, going into the Senate debate we had on Senate voting reform, half the commentators in the country were saying it was going to be the beginning of the end for our party. Half of them were saying, including the Prime Minister, that this was going to be the start of a surge in the Green vote. I don't know. I assume it's going to be a mixed bag for us. I think it depends on individual states.
You've
and
got
and
10
senators
at the moment in the Senate, right?
That's correct, yeah.
So it's hard to see how you could possibly not be worse off, a little worse off in a DD.
Well, I think in a DD, like I said, I think it's a mixed bag, because in a DD, you may look at our vote in a state like Queensland and say, well, we've got a fantastic senator there, but, in a half Senate election where she needs 14%, that's Larissa Waters, she'd be shoo-in in a double dissolution, but I couldn't guarantee that would be the case. Although she's doing great things and the votes, there's some really good things happening in Queensland, I would have thought a half-cent election might be a bigger risk for her. In states where potentially we're at risk.
South Australia,
and I've heard Western Australia, that would be the case in a half-cent election anyway, Michelle. So, I don't think there's any difference. That's my genuine view.
But you would surely come back with fewer than 10?
I think there is potential for an additional Senate seat in Tasmania where I'm running. Christine and myself in 2010 polled nearly 21%, which would have given us three in a double dissolution. Things have changed since 2013. We didn't do as well as we were hoping then, but I think the tide's definitely turned.
How do you think Jackie Lambie will go in Tasmania?
Oh, look, I think she'll, under a double D scenario, she's got a better chance of getting re-elected. As her broader party goes, it's very hard to tell. I think people, you know, they like that she's natural and that she's herself, but whether that actually means they'll vote for her in the ballot box, I'm not really so sure. And I've heard mixed stories about polling numbers, but yeah, and I think she's got a better chance in a double D. In a half Senate election, I'm not so confident.
Let's talk about the lower house, where you've got Adam Bandt, and you do seem to be making progress in inner Melbourne, in inner Sydney.
Yeah.
What do you think the chances are of getting another seat somewhere?
Well, look, it's something we're taking seriously and we're putting a lot of resources into. And I think if recent history tells you anything, it's there can be surprises and rewards for being focused and working hard. Certainly, some of the seats we picked up in Ballina and Northern New South Wales were rewards for a lot of hard work, but it wasn't necessarily expected. So I think you've got to be in it to win it. And I think you've got to have that attitude in politics. You can't be just doing it necessarily to make up the numbers. And as a party, I think we've consistently taken that attitude over the years. So, you know, I think we've got a reasonable chance in Sydney. Everyone's working hard towards it and are expecting a positive outcome.
Which seats do you see as the most vulnerable there?
In Sydney, mm-hmm. to Labor, I'd say Grainer probably would be the most vulnerable. I was saying that I'm no expert on New South Wales politics, but from my understanding, I think that's a possibility that the party's taking seriously.
What about these preference discussions that you've been having with the Liberals, the party's been having with the Liberals? Yep. How do you think that's going to all end up?
Well, look, I don't. I think there's been a lot of misinformation about our preference discussions with the Liberals. I think Labor's been doing that, has been putting that out, probably because it's highlighting their issues around their own preferences. I think we've been very clear that we haven't been having preference discussions with the Liberals. And if we have, certainly the party room and from the leader's office down don't know anything about it. Our party does do preferences, but all I can say, Michelle, is that people should direct their own preferences. This has always been the view of our party. We've consistently advocated for that. And recently with Senate voting reform, we've actually got that legislation finally, after a decade, so people can direct their own preferences, and that would be my advice to them.
So there've been no discussions at all with the Liberals?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Under the new leadership, under Richard Di Natale's leadership, you've obviously been more flexible in dealing with the Liberals at a parliamentary level. Mm. Are you getting any negative reaction from your membership about that?
I think it's all the context that you consider this question. Going back to Christine's leadership, we had the period of the, you know, the, what we call the bust the budget period with Tony Abbott's first budget, which was really required. And Christine was honest. She, in her very first meeting with Tony Abbott, she put up something that they agreed on, and she felt he'd broken his promise, and she'd been open about that. After that, she refused to negotiate with him again, and that was a very important attitude to take in what was a very cruel and unfair budget that I think would have been a disaster. Things have changed with the government since then and with our change of leadership, but we're very focused on getting outcomes in line with our party's policies and our philosophies. We're not getting outcomes for outcome's sake. We're getting them where we actually can achieve what we've been put into Parliament to do.
And so if we see an opportunity, we'll accept that.
Yeah, they do. Our membership, you know, we have a very robust grassroots process around policy, around priorities even within Parliament and how we operate. We are very, very conscious of our membership and all the things we do. Is there sometimes changes afoot within the membership to change policies? Of course there is. Every state conference we have, even at a branch level, all the way through to a national conference, every year we have robust debate on a whole range of issues. People want to change things. That's actually who we are as a party, and we're very proud of that kind of participative democracy. That's one of the four pillars we were set up on as a party.
Now, you're relatively a newcomer to the Senate, not here very long.
I feel like I've been here a long time, I tell you.
How have you found the rough and tumble of it?
A couple of years into it, I was finding it tough going. I haven't found it tough going, although it's getting busier and my responsibilities have increased significantly since Christine's left and we've had reshuffles within portfolios. I think, you know, it took longer than I expected to get my feet on the ground and understand how things work.
What were the difficulties you encountered?
I think actually your resourcing, around, especially how you use the Senate committee system. I mean, I've been involved in about 14 inquiries in the last 12 months and 7 of them that I've initiated. And that's been involved working with a crossbench and with Labor and trying to get outcomes using Parliament. So actually knowing how to use the toolkit that's at your disposal, but not just being on committees for the sake of being on committees, but actually using them to get outcomes in line with your party's policies and your philosophies. You know, it's been the best part of this job. And it's taken me a while to work out how to do that. But lately I feel like that's been very rewarding for me personally and for my team. So yeah, look at I'll be honest with you, I'm not as interested in the rough and tumble and the cut and thrust of politics as much as some other people are. I've never been interested in that part of politics, and kind of wonders why I even put up for pre-selection in the Senate, because I hadn't really planned to be a politician. I try to take an interest in it, but when I get time off, I'd prefer to go surfing or spend time with my family or do other things.
That all-night session over the Senate voting legislation must have been perhaps not a shock to the system, but yeah, not something that you relished.
No, in fact,
that was pretty rough.
It was pretty rough, and I think I got up on the hour and actually called the chamber to, not order, but call them and highlighted to them that we're actually there to get a job done and we should get onto the substantive debate.
I thought
debate.
You were going to say you went out for a quiet moment to meditate or something.
Well, yeah, no, look, it was the very first week I started. We had, back in 2012, of course, we had the issue with another refugee boat going down, the sad loss of life, and that issue reignited significantly, and we had pretty much an all-night debate around the Aboriginal legislation that had come in around the intervention. And I think, you know, that was my first thing. Wow, this is really quite an intense and stressful job. But it, you know, you just need to weigh that up against the rewards. There'll always be something that'll empty your glass in politics, but you'll always find someone who'll fill it, someone who supports what you do. You just got to be very aware of trying to look for the positives.
In many ways, you're representative of a new breed of Greens politicians. Do you feel that the party is shifting at all and picking up new groups of voters that you've previously not appealed to?
I think as generations change, younger voters themselves are presenting new opportunities and new challenges. And I think there's no doubt that, you know, you look at the appeal of someone like Senator Ludlam, Scott Ludlam, that's definitely the case. I mean, I was over campaigning for him for his by-election, as were a number of other the party room, and he's definitely appealing to a new generation of voters. I stood on a street corner in Rockingham waving his sign to people. We've got a push poll where people toot your horn if you're going to vote for Scott. And we saw, you know, young men in there, you know, coming off the building sites in their fluoro jackets going, "Good on you, Scotty." And so there's no doubt that we are appealing to new voters. But I also think there's, to be honest with you, there's also a risk at targeting just new voters or looking for new areas. You've also got to keep your base happy. There are older voters, especially in my state of Tasmania, who, going all the way back to the formulation of our party nearly 40 years ago, that you have to work with. You know, they're just as critical as new voters. You really have to keep your membership happy. You have to keep them active, engaged. You've got to try and inspire them. So it's always a balancing act. But I would say our focus is very much on our older members and voters as much as it's been on attracting new voters.
So would you describe the Greens now as a left party or a party on the left of the centre?
Well, it's a big philosophical question. Look, I don't like the words left and right. I never have. I look at my life experiences and I've been both at different times. I would probably like to say that we're a progressive party rather than the left. But if you look at it from a traditional, traditional point of view, I would say we're a left party, if you want to use that terminology.
Peter Wish Wilson, thanks very much for talking with us today. And that's all from the Conversations Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. That's all for today, and we'll be back soon. I'm Michelle Grattan.